Okay, we are just past the 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and as usual, I'm going to mute all and everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so. If you have a comment or a question, remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the deck as well as contents of the chat window and the audio track will be going up on our website thanks to the hard work of Alan. We have a total of, I think it's 6 items on the agenda tonight, one of which is going to be probably on the lengthy side, so I think we should go ahead and get started. So I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, so we should now have the deck up on the screen.
Yes, indeed.
And okay, first up, I have a YouTube item. Everybody knows I actually quite like Gary Explains, the guy from the Android channel. And he had a posting about how QR codes work. Turned out it wasn't actually very informative, so I was looking around on the web and I found this one from a guy called James Explains how QR codes are built. And I invite you to try this QR code right here, which is one that I built with an online app. And that will be in the deck when you download it. But in the meantime, just a couple of words about the video. As you probably imagined, QR codes are really a bunch of binary bits, and they're in black and white, and the white stands for a binary zero, and the black stands for a binary one. And all QR codes have these three squares in the three corners of the QR code, and they basically are there just to let the scanner align the code so it knows where to look for the various bits and pieces. And then the items down here in this bottom right-hand corner, which are outlined in red, that's the actual data of the information that is encoded in the QR code. And the rest of the black and white digits over here, which aren't coded in red, are kind of timing and content type information, more of a general nature than the actual data that you're trying to provide. And then the next thing, that you can see that the data starts in the right-hand corner. Well, it starts in the right-hand corner over here. And they fill it from right to left and then up, and then they cut across, and then they come down, and then they cut across and they go up. And they basically just fill it with the ones and zeros of the encoding sequence that they want. And so the scanner, and then the gray bars here, they're actually filled with black and white too. And those are error correction codes. So these things are quite robust. If you lose the odd pixel here, then the error correction will sort it out, I guess. So the scanner basically looks at all of these bits of information and sorts out which way around it should be, and then decides what this information is that it's trying to tell you. And the interesting thing I thought was that this QR code is originally developed by a Japanese automotive parts supplier, and they wanted something that was very robust, small, but carried a lot of information, more than just a horizontal barcode. And so they came up with this QR code, and the black and white pixels are essentially a copy of the Japanese game Go, which uses black and white tokens as part of the game. So if you want to know all about QR codes, then this is quite an interesting video to take a look at. Okay, so moving along, Chris has a share here on incognito mode.
Yeah, this was an interesting thing I came across, and I was a little bit surprised that I hadn't heard about this before, but there were some recent developments on it as well, which made it timely to bring forward. So I asked the question in the presentation here, when is incognito mode not incognito? And the answer is when it's done by Google. So Google has incognito mode. So next. So incognito mode is what Google calls their private browsing. And I did write an article on incognito mode and in the newsletter, and that's in the chat as well as you see it on the screen there. Next. And then it turns out that Google had actually settled a lawsuit that claimed that it was secretly tracking internet uses of people who thought they were browsing privately. So they were in incognito mode, but yet Google was actually tracking them. And Google Analytics would track them. Cookies and apps let Alphabet track activity, even when it was set to incognito mode. Next. So this was a quote out of the lawsuit, and they said it turned Google into an unaccountable trove of information, and it let them learn things about their friends, hobbies, favorite foods, everything else on there, and the URL about that. And you can see that this goes back to December of 2023, that there was actually this settlement. Next. So what is new on it is that in terms of what the settlement actually came down to, and Google has agreed now to destroy billions of records. They will update their disclosures, and Google has actually usually been pretty good about disclosing information about what they collect and things like that. But in this case, they obviously were doing a not terribly great job. So they're going to update that to include what they collect in private browsing, and they will let incognito users block third-party cookies for 5 years. Now, I don't know what that really means and how it's going to be implemented and so forth, but that's all they had to say in the settlement news. Next. So the plaintiff's lawyers wrote that Google will now collect less data. They didn't say no data when people are in private browsing, but it'll be less data, and they will make less money from the data. I'm not saying they will make no money from your data when you're in private browsing mode. Next. Perhaps most egregious, I think, in all of this is the users will not receive any damages through this particular lawsuit. However, they are still free to sue individually for damages. Now, I don't know if there's any possibility that somebody will be able to get a class action against Google. I would hate to think that this is a remedy that is considered serious unless it's class action. Nobody is going to go and sue individually Google for damages that might amount to hundreds or even thousands of dollars when Google's got all of the lawyers they have at their control. Anyhow, I thought it was an interesting article, and maybe the takeaway from this is don't trust private browsing mode. That's it. Oh, yeah, sorry. I have one more slide. Yeah. The point on this slide is incognito mode still useful? And I think it actually is. It's just not going to protect you from things like Google snooping on your data. If you want to use it to sign into multiple user accounts in the browser, it can be really handy because it keeps them separate. So you can have one browsing window logged into one account, one logged into another account, and the two don't intermix or anything like that, which can be very useful at certain times. Next. Another use for it is, you know, if you're shopping and it's a shared computer, you know how as soon as you go looking at something, like you're going to look at shoes or something like that, then all of a sudden everywhere you go, you see ads for shoes. Well, if it's a shared computer, it might give away a secret that you're looking for a particular thing, and maybe that's a gift for somebody. Who knows? Next. Autofill is kind of a good one. You know how when you're filling in forms and things like that, you get these autofill suggestions from something that you have done previously. And incognito mode can prevent those suggestions from coming up. So it's just getting rid of an annoyance more than anything else. Next. If you're booking things or you're going for online shopping, this is a well-known thing. Some companies actually keep track of the fact that you've been there, you've looked on something before, and if you come back, they'll increase the price, thinking that, well, you're really interested in buying it, therefore I'll jack the price up a little bit and you'll still maybe be interested enough that you'll actually pay it. So if you're in incognito mode, you will get around that particular problem. Next. And the other one on here, this is, I think it's a useful thing as well, that you can get a different perspective on things. So things like YouTube often will give you suggestions for new videos based on videos that you've watched in recently. And so if you want to get away from that and just have a fresh perspective on it, and it's not based on something you've done previously, this may be a way of getting that new perspective. And then finally, if you happen to be a web developer and you've developed your website and you want to see that website as it would be seen by an outsider, if you look at it in incognito mode, it will give that fresh look at things, you hope, anyways. It's probably more in line with what somebody brand new to your website would actually see. And so that's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris, but don't go away because the next item is you on sharing files.
Yeah, okay. The let me just paste in the URLs for that. So I came across this very interesting article from Windows Intelligence, and it talked about means of sharing files. And I thought that it was really well done and a lot of interesting means of going about doing it. There used to be in Windows 7 the concept of home groups, and it made it really quite easy to share files between multiple computers. And unfortunately, Microsoft did away with home groups, so that is no longer available as a means of sharing files between multiple devices. Next. So the article actually listed four options. There's wireless nearby sharing, sharing files in the cloud, network cache storage, and traditional network Windows network file sharing. Next. Tonight, we're going to cover off wireless nearby sharing and share files in the cloud. And then we'll cover off the other two probably next week. Next. So nearby sharing, what is it? It's sort of like anybody who knows about Apple's AirDrop or Google QuickShare, it's basically that sort of idea that you can just connect to other computers or devices that are nearby you and allow you to move files between the two devices relatively easily. In Windows 11, you go to Settings, Systems, Nearby Sharing, next. And in Windows 10, you go to Settings, System, Shared Experiences. And basically, the dialog boxes have the same content in there, just laid out a little bit differently. Windows 11, you actually see the three options. It'll be off by default. And then you can share with just your devices, which means that you are signed into multiple computers using the same Microsoft account. That's what they mean by My Devices. Or you can have it everybody nearby, and there it doesn't matter how they're signed into Windows at all. On Windows 10, you have it as a drop-down list, but it's basically the three options are there. Again, it'll be off by default, and then you can go into either My Devices Only or Everyone Nearby. Next. Okay, so how do you go about using it? So if you go into Windows File Explorer, you go into the directory or the folder where you actually want to share the particular file. You right-click on the file. So in this case, I've right-clicked on Brighter Than the Sun, and then you get a pop-down menu. Next.
And just before you move on there, Tom's asking, for nearby, do you need to be on the same network, or does Bluetooth work too?
No, I'll have a bit on that as well. It'll work on Wi-Fi or it'll work on Bluetooth. So then you'll get the pop-up menu and you click on Share. And then this is assuming that you already turned on nearby sharing in the previous screen. Then you'll come up with a list of other computers that are nearby you that are willing to accept sharing. And so you click on the computer, and then you will get a notification that says that you're sharing to, and then the computer name of the other computer, in this case it's Kuma, what the file is that is being shared, in this case Brighter Than the Sun, and then it says it's waiting for Kuma to accept. Next. On the other computer, they'll get a pop-up, and in this case here, it looks a little bit different because this is a Windows 10 computer on the other side, and they get a notification, they saying receiving from, and it'll have your computer name, so this in Aquila is my main computer, and it has the file that is being transferred, Brighter Than the Sun, and then you can either decline it or save it. And or you can do a save and open. So if you do a save, it'll actually pop up and ask you, you know, standard dialog box where you want to save and things like that. And then next, once you accept it, the first computer will get a notification saying that it was successfully sent. So really, really simple way of actually doing this. So next.
So Karen wants to know, what's the proximity distance?
The next slide will probably tell you on that. So the summary on it is it's really good for sending just a few files. You can't send a folder. If you just have one or two files, it's really fast and easy to do it. It does require manual action on both ends to send and receive. So I can't force it to another computer, nor can I demand a file from another computer. It has to be both sides, one side saying, I want to send you this, and the other side saying, yes, I want to receive that. It does work over Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, so the limitations for distance on that, Bluetooth is typically about 30 feet in the clear, and then Wi-Fi is up to, you know, about 300 feet, I guess, or I think it's about, maybe it's 100 feet in the clear. Depends on the version of Wi-Fi that you're actually using, what distance it'll be. But if you're both on the same Wi-Fi network, you should have no problems at all. I find it very, very simple to use. So it's easy to instruct somebody else. I'm going to send you a file here. And you'll get a pop-up. Just accept it. It'll end up in your downloads directory. Jeff, no, it will not work between Android. It's just a Windows-to-Windows thing. Nearby sharing is a pure Windows option. Next. So the next thing is in cloud storage. And so this can be really useful under a number of circumstances. There are a lot of options for sharing files through cloud storage. So Google Drive, Microsoft OneDrive are the two big heavyweights, I guess. There's Dropbox, and there's lots of other ones that are out there. Typically, you can get anywhere from about 2 to 15 gigabytes for free. And then if you need more space than that in your sharing or your storage, definitely all of the cloud storage providers will sell you additional space based on a monthly or yearly rate. Next. So there's two ways that I look at that you can really use the cloud storage for sharing. You can do it automatic synchronization between multiple computers, presumably computers that you use. I use it. I have it automatic synchronization going on between my main desktop computer and the two laptop computers that I own. Or you can do a manual sharing, and that's more useful when you're trying to share something with some other person or a group of people. Next, and I'll go through each of these options. You can control that sharing when you're sharing it with other people, that you can have it anybody with the link that you provide or that comes across that link somehow, or you can do it to specific people. And then when you're sharing, you can either do it as a read-only, where they can only read the content, or you can do it editable, where they can actually change the content for that shared file. It's your choice on that, on the sharing. Next. Okay, so for doing it with automatic synchronization, so the general method on this is it varies a little bit vendor to vendor. What I'm going to have here is how it's done on Google Drive, if there's anything that is specific on my slides. Basically, you install the program that allows that automatic synchronization. So it'll install on the desktop. It will be set to start up automatically with Windows, and it'll run as a service. So you can just have it available to you all the time. So you install it on every one of the computers where you want that automatic synchronization done, and each of those has to have that app logged into the cloud service using the same account. Then you configure folders on the local computer for synchronization between the multiple computers. By default, something like Google Drive, it just has a My Drive folder that is under the user profile. You can set it up to synchronize additional folders if you want. Then what you can do is you can just edit your files normally on the local files that are set up for that synchronization, and then when the app running on your computer sees that there's a new file or a changed file in that local set of folders, it'll automatically synchronize it up to the cloud. And then once it's synchronized up to the cloud, it'll automatically be synced down to other computers that are set up with that particular app on the computer. Next. So this is a pictorial of the automatic synchronization, and so you can see double-headed arrows on all three of these computers. And so if I actually make a change on any one of these computers, it gets synced up to the cloud, and then it'll get synced down automatically to the other two computers without any intervention on my part at all. So again, it does require that your cloud provider have that program that will do that synchronization for you. Google has it. Certainly Microsoft OneDrive has it. Some of the other cloud providers, they will only give you that synchronization if you pay for a service. They won't give it to you on a free service. Next, one other that's on there is Dropbox. Definitely has on their free service. They have the app available as well. I'm not really familiar with other cloud providers. Next. Okay, so how do you go about configuring for manual sharing? So this is just it's not necessarily with another computer that you own that you want to synchronize the file. It's you want to give other people access to a set of files. So you can right-click on either the file or you can share a whole folder. So you can right-click on the files or folders for sharing, choose what access you want to that for other people. You can have it either anyone who has the link or specific people. Now, the one tricky thing with specific people is that because you want to specify specific people, the only means of authentication is an account with the cloud service provider. Now, if you're on Google, basically you can do that with anybody who has a Gmail account because that is automatically a Google account. If you are on Microsoft, it's pretty simplified as well. As long as the people are logged into Windows using a Microsoft account, you can use that Microsoft account for synchronization. If you're on something like Dropbox, the other people that you want to be able to access these files are going to have a Dropbox account as well. Now, if they're doing it through the free, you can do it with anyone with the link to the file or folder. They don't have to have an account on the service. Then you choose the edit rights that you want, either read-only or editable. And then you send that link to other people, and they click on the link, and the file or folder will open up in their browser, and they can read or download the files, and if they have edit capabilities, they'll be able to edit it as well. Next. Okay, so pictorial on that. Basically, what you do is you share the file in the cloud service. It gets put on the cloud service, and the security and so forth is set on it. The link is set to there. Next. Then what you do is you send the link to everybody through email or whatever you want to share with, and then they will have either, as the green arrow is, people have read-only access, or if you set it up where you can control it so they have editable capability, is like the purple arrow, where they can actually read the file or they could change the file. If they change the file, it'll get changed on the cloud service, and then you can get the change from there. Next. So a summary of the cloud storage, if you have synchronization, it does require that program from a cloud provider to be on every computer that you want that synchronization to happen on. I find it really, really great to keep files in sync between multiple computers. So an example of that is all of the library presentations that I give, or any of the presentations I give anywhere, I have all of those files are in synchronized folders. So if I'm editing a file, presentation file on my desktop computer, as soon as I save it, it gets synchronized back up to the cloud, and the next time I'm on my laptop, it'll get synchronized down to the laptop. So when I go to the library, I'll have the up-to-date file. If I made a change to a file while I'm at the library giving a presentation, by the time I get home, it's already synchronized back to my desktop computer as well. So it keeps all of those files in sync on all of the computers that I'm likely to use. It's automatic. No action is required once it's set up. It just works. It's not instantaneous. It can take up to a couple of minutes to synchronize, but usually it's within a minute of any change is synchronized to the cloud, and usually within about another minute, it'll be synchronized to any other PC that is connected to the internet. If you're doing it without the synchronization, it's great for easily sharing files to anybody, anywhere in the world. You don't have to email big files around and things like that. It does require that if you want to have it to specific people, that they have that account with the cloud provider as well. And next, So that's all I have for this week. Next week, I will cover off network attached storage and then traditional Windows network file sharing. And do we have any questions?
Tom had put in a link here for peer-to-peer file synchronization. And so okay. That, I guess, will answer the question of what these different things will do and not do.
Yeah.
Jeff says he used to use Dropbox all the time, but on a free account, it's now limited to 3 active devices.
Okay.
Other cloud storage systems, pCloud, MegaSync, and they have active sync and don't limit the number of devices on free accounts.
Okay. Personally, I really like Google Drive because it doesn't limit you in terms of the number of devices, and as well, you get 15 gigabytes for free, which is really, really nice.
And to follow on that, Carol wants to know, if I have multiple Gmails, do I have multiple space in the drive?
Yes.
If you sync, does it reduce the space on all?
Yes, it will reduce the space. No, because they are separate. So any one Gmail account, you'll be able to synchronize between multiple computers as long as they are the app is using that one Gmail account. You can't synchronize between multiple Gmail accounts. So you could set it up so that if say you have 2 computers, you could have the Google Drive app installed on both computers, but they have to point to the same Gmail account. Now, if you're sharing it where you're just sending people links, you can use multiple Gmail accounts, no problem. You just have to go on to the particular Gmail cloud storage for the account that you want to share the file, and then create the link from there and give that to the people.
Also, I'd like to point out that using Google Drive allows you to restrict editing. So, Matt, I use this with Google Docs a lot. You can share documents and spreadsheets and maps from your Google Drive, and people can see everything, but they can't change anything. So it's a kind of an alternative to having a website.
I pointed that out I pointed that out when you're sharing, that you set the permissions on it, whether people have read-only access or they have edit rights. So you can choose that. You choose it on a file-by-file basis, so you can't have it where you have one file and then you have one person has read access and one person has read-write access. I think it has to be one for everybody on it. But you do have the ability to choose that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I think that's covered all of the questions in the chat. If anybody has any other questions, just add them to the chat, and we'll get to them later on or follow up next week. Okay, so next up, we have an interesting share. A couple of weeks ago, we had a question about cutting the cable. And if you cut the cable, it means that you probably want to stream television content over the Internet. And Jeff Dubois has been doing this for a long time, and he has some interesting thoughts on Internet Protocol television. So Jeff is going to share his screen. I noticed he's unmuted his mic, so we're all set to go.
Okay, this is going to take me a minute. Internet Protocol television, IPTV. I've put my email address there because often there's questions. So if I'll show it again at the end, I'm easily available through the forum as well. Pretty easy to find me. So, Internet Television Protocol.
Legal disclaimer. I do not develop, distribute, or administer streaming applications, add-ons, streaming websites, or streaming services. Furthermore, I cannot determine the legality of any streaming platform referred to in this presentation, which is hereby given solely for educational purposes. The end user is solely responsible for media they may choose to access, and I assume that all streaming platforms referred to are abiding by copyright laws and licensing requirements set forth within the applicable jurisdiction. Users should only stream works not protected by copyright when using unverified streaming solutions.
So there we go. A little bit of a disclaimer. The audio portion of the talk is not going to be saved to the website. I always have concerns because the law changes in respect to streaming, and we see this constantly. You see, well, if you follow Facebook, you can't even get a news source now. So as the laws change, you know, what one says may or may not be valid 2 days or 5 days or a year from now. So that's basically it. Those are the programs. That's IPTV. Tons of information and programs.
Okay, great, Jeff. Thank you very much for that. Really interesting. Can you make sure that you include in your slide package the links to the various free TV providers? I'm sure people want to try some of those.
Yes, I will. It's the GitHub is the good one to experiment with the TV Mate. TV Mate's available right on the Microsoft Windows Store. If you don't have a Microsoft account, you can grab it easily.
I didn't see any questions, but there's a lot of people here saying great presentation and thank you and all that kind of good stuff. So well done. Well done, Jeff. And so we don't have enough time for questions this week, but if you have any questions for next week, then our next Q&A session is on April 24th, which is next Wednesday. As usual, if you have any questions, just send them along to our suggestion box address. And if you have brand new topics that you would like to share, just like Jeff, send us some details on that too. And we'll be happy to include you in next week's list of presentations. So I hope everybody enjoyed the content tonight. Very varied and quite interesting, I thought. So we'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks, folks. Have a good week.